This is a Bengali intellectual oral history interview on August 25th, 2010 with Professor Gayatri Spivak at Columbia University. And let's begin. Professor Spivak, could you begin just by recording your date of birth and where you were born?
Okay, but first perhaps that my professional name is, of course, Gayatri Chakravorty Spivak.
Yes.
Just Gayatri Spivak. My date of birth is 24th February 1942, and I was born at 6 Ironside Road in Calcutta.
Now, could you tell us a bit about your childhood and the milieu of your childhood? What strikes you through as you recall it?
Well, first of all, this area of Calcutta was then on the outskirts of Calcutta, right? So it was like I was born in the what used to be the garden house of my mother's father, and it was during the evacuation of Calcutta for fear of Japanese bombing. But my mother decided that she would remain, she wouldn't go anywhere, so my grandmother also remained. And so that's why I was born in Calcutta, and I'm, for some obscure reason, I'm quite happy about it. And the thing is, I'm not a nationalist, but I love cities, and I consider myself both a New Yorker and a Calcuttan. It's easier to say that in terms of identity than for me, as you just put it, Bengali or Indian, or of course I'm not American, but I've lived here for nearly 50 years, so therefore I could even say that I was. But the city somehow for me is a place that identifies me. Perhaps it's because I grew up in Calcutta. So the area that I grew up in is called Baliganj. And Baliganj is something you will find it today online, and I was quite happy to see that my childhood, our Baliganji girls' generalizations about Baliganj were actually borne out by this online thing, that we were considered to be very independent-minded and feisty young women. And this was kind of nice. And this was, of course, I was born before the partition of India, and which is more important in some ways to my generation than what is called independence, and especially if you grow up in Bengal or Punjab. And so what happened was that the face of Calcutta changed when there were refugees coming in from what was then East Pakistan in 47. And so my first years are marked by, first of all, this area, which was so much an outskirt that you could hear kind of jackals screaming away, etc. It was a very strange kind of place. And my father built a little house there because the Rana of Nepal had given him fees in a bag of pure gold coins. I just saw one of those gold coins this afternoon in my bank vault. But the building, my little house where I grew up, was built with those gold coins because my father was not a particularly rich man. I found this out from my mother much later because I was curious as to how my father built such a nice little house during the war when everything was very expensive. And my mother said, "Ah, you don't know, it was with the gold mohurs from Nepal." So anyway, so we were very happy in our little house. My father was a diagnostic radiologist, but now my mother was an intellectual. And she, when there was independence, she at dawn would kind of buzz off to the stations to receive the refugees, and she was interested in refugee rehabilitation, a very serious worker. And she was married when she was 14, and my brother was born when she was 15. But what did happen was that my father saw that his bride was an intellectual. Not just, you know, women should be educated, it wasn't like that. My mother was in fact more of an intellectual than I am. And this is just this is a kind of judgment that I came to later life. And I would say to her that, you know, if you had had my parents and had been born when I was born, you would have hit the stratosphere. She was a very solid person. So she, so my father made it possible, because in those days, you know, in the 20s and 30s, it would not have been possible for her to go through institutional education without my father's support, not in her class. And she finally got an MA in Bengali literature in 1937, when she was 24. And then she would have gone on to do a PhD on Bengali proverbs.
And but this was where? Did she get her?
University of Calcutta, so my university. And so she was, but she gave up for a reason that is also worth talking about if it's my childhood we are speaking of. My father was from, I just gave a lecture in Calcutta, the Dilip Kumar Roy Memorial Lecture, which Shugato, I believe, gave some, maybe last year. And I actually spoke about constructing a personal past. How does one construct? Because the Dilip Kumar Roy, which I don't think my hosts knew, he was my mother's first cousin. And in fact, he and my mother were born in the same house. So, you know, it was hard. So I did that, and I showed a PowerPoint, you know, pictures of my childhood. And it was very, very clear to the audience that if on my mother's side I come from this, you know, like Calcutta intellectual Bengali family, which is much beloved, especially by people who live abroad, I don't have much going for it. On my father's side, I mean, the photograph of my father's father was so unlike the photographs of my grandfather's generation, my great-grandfather's generation, in their suits and their mustaches and their nice heavy build and so on. My father's father was lean, bare-bodied, wearing a dhoti, smiling, with a beard, a village man, you know, quite a powerful man, but did not know any English at all, not to read or write or anything. So my father came from that kind of a background, and it's a Horatio Alger story. He refused a dowry in 1928, which really was a fairly unusual thing. And then he actually studied radiology with Rutherford at Cambridge, and then he came back and he was made the youngest civil surgeon in Eastern India by the British government. And he was asked to give false evidence at a rape trial. And he refused without even thinking for 1 second. And so therefore he was dismissed, and his wonderful career was destroyed at the age of 41. So, I mean, this is someone that we are very proud of.
What was his name?
Paresh Chandra Chakravarti. Very proud of.
And your mother's name?
Shivani Chakravarti. But my mother, my parents ran a little salon where, before all of this disaster, they were the beautiful people. They ran a little salon because, you know, they were, my father and my mother would go off to play soccer with my brother, you know, the three of them in Ramna and so on. I think my father drove a Sunbeam Talbot or a Peugeot or some such thing. And people really noticed this young couple. They're full of joy and, you know. And they had these intellectuals, the famous poet Buddhadev Bose, for example, Utpala Sen, Humayun Kabir, Sayyid Mustafa Ali, all these people, the young, they would come to their house and there would be a certain kind of, and you find acknowledgements in their writings. And then when my father came back to Calcutta, he became a kind of saintly person, you know, huge. I mean, of course, he had a diagnostic radiology practice, but he had a huge charitable practice, and he was very active during the Hindu-Muslim riots in kind of protecting Muslims who were in the area, etc., from violence. It's, you know, they would come into our house and so on. So he was my parents were very plain living, high thinking, anti-casteist, anti-sectarian, anti-communal in the Indian sense, you know, I mean, no religious anything. And so they were like very unusual people in this sense, and they were proto-feminists. In other words, they brought us up the one boy and the three girls were brought up the same way. You see, we were not prepared for marriage. We were not, I didn't know how to cook, etc. This is a very a strange thing. And so it's, that's my childhood, an extremely happy childhood of, you know, discipline for sure, but also no differentiation between the boy and the girls.
Do you think there is a background in terms of a Brahmo background or a secular background, or where did your parents
My parents were not Brahmos. My father, I mean, I think the influence on them was of the Ramakrishna movement. My father was initiated by Ramakrishna's wife, and in 1920. And my father was like me, or I am like my father, I should say. I now realize he died in 1955 when I was 13. I was quite precocious, so I had begun to get to know him some. I was in college, I'd just entered college. But what happened, my father never in his entire life spoke about that experience at all. And I myself, when I was about that age, and he was 19 when he chose to get initiated by Ramakrishna's wife in Calcutta, at 18, I also, nobody among my siblings was initiated or anything. My parents were not like that, you know, they wouldn't ask that this should happen through parental interference. But at 18, I got myself initiated. I took the bus number 56 to Belur. I got myself initiated by the wonderful man, Shankarananda, the head of the Ramakrishna Mission. But then at 21, I lost my faith completely. I'm a totally non-religious person. But I certainly look back upon the initiation with joy. And I don't do anything at all. And I think that my father's experience was of that sort, a very kind of profoundly, it's a kind of ethico-epistemological experience. It's not the kind of stereotype, you know, Semitized Hinduism, etc. That's more Vivekananda. But Ramakrishna was an ecstatic. It's a different kind of thing. Mm. And so, I think they were also rather unusual because my mother's siblings were not like her. You know, they had the general characteristics that stereotypically can be attributed to educated sort of Bengal Renaissance people, but they were certainly not like her in this kind of obsessive attraction to the expanding of the mind. No.
When did you get the feeling or the sense that you were an intellectual? Or that there
15.
How did that happen?
I remember running in the dark down the long lane. I was in Presidency College of English Honours, saying to myself, I believe I'm an intellectual. You know, it was just the most incredible thing. Mm. It was silly. Mm. But there it was.
Had you read something or had you had a conversation?
No. It was just one of those Wordsworthy at spots of time. Silly. Because I'm not really very much of an intellectual in many, many ways. I'm not, because I'm not, I don't have any kind of curiosity, and I'm not very, quote, cultured. I don't have a scholarly kind of disposition. I like to think. This is incontrovertible. Mm. I like to think. Sometimes think well, but I'm not an intellectual in the sense in which, you know, real scholars are. No. I mean, I'm not a Ranadit Guha or Tapan Raj Chaudhuri, no. Of course, they're also historians, and that's a different kind of... I mean, the people that you have interviewed, almost all have been either historians or politically involved in some way. I'm a reader, which is a very different kind of thing.
So what kinds of conversations or books or people were you engaging with, say, in this period, in the early Presidency College time, when you went to college, or whenever these conversations and these discussions of ideas became important to you? Can you maybe open up some of that?
Reading, I mean, conversations, I think, intellectual conversations, I think, I mean, you see, you will find that Bengalis insist that they had intellectual conversations, especially those who went to Presidency College or the coffee house or anything. I will say that having been part of that crowd, I don't know that it was really like, I mean, the intellectual content of the discussions were not like tremendously impressive. Certainly one had some discussions here and there with perhaps, but I think I began to have intellectual discussions, quote unquote, later in life, that during the Presidency College days, it was more like doing well in, I'm sorry if I sound unlike the other Presidency College people, but it really was a fact that there was a great deal of emphasis on the appearance of intellectual brilliance. Mm. And so that was, I don't think that was a good influence. I think what was good was that because there wasn't, certainly in English, a lot of books available. I mean, for us, Pater's Renaissance was a secondary text on the Renaissance, you know, that kind of stuff. We learned to think on our feet well. Yeah, that's lasted me. And from the point of view of education, I had very solid teachers, yes, but the one who has really, and I don't mean to be disrespectful of my other teachers, they were good, strong, wonderful teachers, but the one who really taught me how to play reading, you know, like how to play a game, was Tarknath Sen. He was a person who taught me something that has lasted to this day, and it's very, very difficult, that is to say, to be absolutely literal. It was not to be absolutely literal. It was not really much of like intellectual discussions about anything. That's the real skill, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So, no, I wasn't, I mean, one was having, I suppose, I mean, if you push me, I can start to think, okay, Rudra Prasad Sengupta, perhaps one talked a little bit about, I mean, there were, of course, political discussions, because you know, it was, people were, young people were more politicized, right? I mean, so electoral education, going into the villages, marching in the streets, you know, yes, those kinds of things. But what one would call intellectual discussions, I had later in life. Mm-hmm. I think that I'm obliged to say that.
And where did you stay when you were going to college?
At home.
At home. And I'm just curious how you would come to college. What was the actual route
bus
that you would take? Every day you would just catch a bus and go back?
Yeah.
And
tram to Bremen College. The first 2 years I went to Lady Bremen College because Presidency didn't take young women until the third year. See? So then it was bus or tram. One could even walk to Lady Bremen.
What was your experience of being a woman at Presidency in this period?
Didn't think of it.
Didn't.
No. I mean, now I find that anybody who writes about me, and you know, these my contemporary intellectuals have written about me, like Shuni Gangopadhyay and this guy Tushar Kanti, something or the other, they all comment on the fact that I was incredibly good looking and that I was, and they use this silly phrase, femme fatale, etc., etc. But I was completely innocent. I did not think of myself specifically as a woman, no. I was very, very young. I mean, I entered third year presidency at 15 and I left the country at 19. So it was, I wasn't like a grown up person. And so I didn't feel that I was any different because I was female. Slowly, of course, I began, like most young women, to become sexually aware. But that's really, I mean, is that to feel different because one is a woman? I suppose it is. But how would I describe? How I would describe sort of slow growth into the awareness of one's sexuality the way that anybody would, wouldn't they? So that's what it was.
Did you feel that the intellectual world up to this point was very Anglo-centric, or did you feel that there were windows that were open to explore beyond, say, the British axis? And is that, or is that something that would happen later on, in terms of your reading, or in terms of what you were thinking about?
At home, the center was very Bengali. I mean, I just saw in my, as I was going through my brother's collection of books, the old Bankimchandra Chattopadhyay collected works that were my father's, out of which I actually read those novels, the actual books, and my niece and nephew, who are, one of them is 54 and the other 47, they're not exactly children, they were quite bemused by the fact that I wanted to get to Durgeshnandini, because I remember reading that first page. So there was a great deal of reading in Bengali, so it wasn't, I would say that it was very Bangla-centric rather than Anglo-centric. We did not have much contact with British anything until I entered college, and then it became, and it may be that there were people around me who were more British-centric, but in my case it was focused on what we were studying, you know, Shakespeare, T.S. Eliot, Lamb, stuff like that. Amol Bhattacharjee was very aware of the new critics. Remember, this was 57 to 59, and then 59 to 61 I was doing my MA. So through him we heard about the new critics, and so that part, that little bit was American. But from my family background, since there was so much Bengali at home, I did not live an Anglo-centric life at all. No. I went to a Bengali medium school until class 7, same school. After class 7 it became English medium.
But what school was that?
St. John's Diocesan Girls High School. And it was, I saw for the first time our parish church last December. I didn't know, it was not at all a religious, it wasn't a convent, no white teachers. Generally speaking, there's a great difference between missionary schools and convents. Convents like Loreto, La Martiniere, those schools were, they anglicized you. But I still feel, maybe I'm wrong, that the child loses contact with the life of Calcutta if they go to that sort of a school. Whereas in our school, or Gokhale, or Beltala, or United Methodist, or, you know, those schools, we were solidly in the life of the city. Now, so it wasn't at all religious. So therefore, we didn't even know that we had a parish church. But Rudrangshu Mukherjee took a whole group that I took to Calcutta, preservationists. I asked Rudrangshu to take us for a little tour of Calcutta. And the first place he went to, my sister was with me, she also went to diocese, and we all went there. And we realized this 18th century church, St. John's Parish Church, it was our church. It was a fantastic healing. And I'll say that it was a very intellectual school, because the teachers were converted aboriginals and so-called low castes, and so therefore they were completely inspired with the love of education, and they felt that it was a fantastic thing that they were educating. Basically, we didn't really understand that then, but as I grew older, I realized that they were extremely excited that they were actually educating upper caste Hindu children, Muslim children, and so on and so forth. It was a very, very wonderful atmosphere. I learned all my Sanskrit from one of these Bengali Christian teachers, and absolutely adored Sanskrit. So it was, school experience was 100%. I'm so happy that my parents sent me to that school, I cannot tell you. So that was my school. In fact, the principal, Miss Das, Charubala Das, she becomes my role model more and more as I go through life.
In what way?
Because that she was interested in an ethical education without any kind of religious cant or cant of spirituality or anything. And of course she was also a single woman who had, like, you know, a great deal of dignity in a man's world. So she was, I find her, the more I think about her, the more I feel drawn to her example.
Do you think that in the 1950s when you were receiving your education in Calcutta, that it was a special time in the sense that this is there was an efflorescence of kind of a new Bengali literature, the young writers, Budde Bose, you mentioned, the new comparative literature department, the great poets like Jivanananda Das, who had just, I suppose, passed away recently. But I know that that, from what I've understood, that was quite a climate in the 1950s. Did you feel that? And were you tapped into these, say, little magazine context?
I was both a little too young and a little too old. See, because what you will get from Ranjitha or from Tapunda or from Amutto, I'm much younger than they are. And so I didn't have the sense of Jivanananda and Buddhadev. Remember, Buddhadev was in my parents' salon before I was born, right? Buddhadev's daughters went to school with us. So we thought of them as, of course, we knew that he was a great poet, etc. So I don't believe, you see, since I left at 19, the time for thinking that, there was this kind of atmosphere growing, I was not old enough yet. And so I didn't feel, therefore, and Bengali, what efflorescence would I feel? My mother was a Bengali specialist, right? And so I was within that. I mean, I thought all children knew as many proverbs as I did. So the fact that these people were, I mean, Ghaji Nazrul Islam was a friend of this Dilip Roy's, and therefore my mother's Kajida, and so on and so forth. These things didn't mean anything because they were all part of the sort of family atmosphere, right? So, no, I don't believe I thought. And also, if you really think about childhood experiences, what were my experiences? Famine and riot. Those were the two that really made a mark. I mean, I went to school in 1946, entered kindergarten. In October, school was closed. And this Baliganj where I was born, that's exactly where Sayyid Amir Ali Avenue ends. So on the cusp of the Hindu and the Muslim sections. So, I would hear at night, Jai Kali Kalkatte Wali, Bolo Hori, Hori Bol, Allahu Akbar. And each cry meant someone knifed someone, because that one was fought with machetes and knives, right, not guns. And there was, strictly speaking, blood on the street. So who would think about literature? And then famine. Technically speaking, that man-made famine, technically it was no longer a famine by 43, I think. But that's when the technical definition ended. As for the experience of the famine, like skeletons crawling almost naked to the back door asking for starch, mardama, pandama. This is my childhood experience. And these people, doctor, sports doctor in California, once when I had a stress fracture because I'd been running on concrete, he asked me where I was born and when. And he said what we already knew experientially, not by reading books, that there was so much malnutrition that even the middle class, like ourselves, who had meals, three meals a day for sure, even we were malnourished. And of course, the others, the famine victims, were there for the child. So frankly speaking, I was not thinking about we sang the IPTA songs, but really without the sense that this was a cultural good. It was, they were actually politically, political instruments, the Ardevuna, Ardevuna, those kinds of songs. So no, I think if one wanted to ask me what my real impression was, the impression was riots and famine. Yeah. And they marked me, and independence compared to that was like you know, very nice, you know, wearing white and blue and kind of singing the inevitable Tagore songs, etc. I'm not a great Tagore fancier either. We are not Shantiniketan people at all. So therefore, there wasn't that either. It's, no, I would say that in the general life of the Bengali child in Calcutta, it was not a sense of a literary awakening or anything. I mean, there were great poets, don't get me wrong. I mean, there was, we were surrounded by these wonderful poets, the Anuradha Shankar Rai and Bishnu Day and so on and so forth. But the sense that, you know, no, that's not my life. I mean, Nabonita, after all, is from a literary family, right? So Nabonita's sense of things is different because her parents were part of that scene. But my parents, after all, were not poets. My father was a doctor and mother was a social worker, which is a very different thing.
So not to go on much longer in our interview, but maybe we can conclude by crossing to the next phase, just to provide a bookend. These experiences that you've spoken about, particularly famine and then partition, you left at 19, which is also quite an impressionable age. So when you went on to the other side, can you give some sense of what that was like, and maybe also if there was a moment then you realized what your vocation would be, or if that would come much later? Or
what vocation?
As a, say, as a writer, a teacher, or a, I mean, the kind of intellectual that you were then to be, if that.
I don't think I ever had a real sense of it. It happened to me rather than anything, and that is true even now. I'm always a little surprised by what happens to what I find myself doing. So that's why I said again and again, it was silly that. That evening when I ran down Baliganj Park Road saying to myself, I believe I'm an intellectual, because, you know, that stuff, I never have a sense of a real vocation. The that is not completely correct. Having said that sentence, I think in the last 25 years, what I call supplementing vanguardism, that has become a bit of an obsession rather than a vocation. But that's a different thing. I, you know, that came in the last 25 years, that's just yesterday. And so when I first came to the United States, I felt, of course, that I knew everything, you know, because, you know, smart Calcutta girl. But it was, of course, a very wonderful time. I mean, I went to Cornell, and I heard Malcolm X speak with James Brown and Timothy Leary and Richard Alpert, and I sang on the harmonium with Allen Ginsberg and Leroy Jones. That's what he was then. And I was in this honor society, and the young men went down to Philadelphia. They went down to Philadelphia, Mississippi, and got killed. It was just a... And the Beatles' second album, 62. So... You know, all of that strain. I was very much a part of it, rather than a young part of it, rather than any kind of Bengali anything. I have never in my life tried to remain a Bengali. Whatever has remained, it has remained because it's a culture. I mean, I've not tried not to be a Bengali either. No resistance, and no. And so, this business of a PhD and college teacher, etc. That was like falling off a log. Nobody ever expected I would do anything. So it did anything other than that. So it was like completely rote. It was not anything else. And especially going into literature, there was just like water flowing. But the 60s in the United States were, and especially at Cornell at that time, they were, I mean, when I think that I heard Malcolm X, I still can't get over it.
What was that like? I'm curious.
It was very rousing. And I could feel that everything, I mean, it could speak to a Bengali person, because it was really, it was the same kind of wavelength, the way Malcolm spoke. And James Brown was much more careful and rational and good, but that was not what we were, right? Because I did know some American students before, etc. And they seemed to me, remember the 50s, they seemed to me to be too sort of drip dry in pastel shades, etc. But Malcolm was not like that. Malcolm was like us. And so I remember that as a young person, I thought I was able to move with him. You know what I mean? So it's an, there weren't, I mean, at a certain point, Romila Thapar, my friend, said to me that going to Britain for students from Calcutta and Delhi is like going to a somewhat cleaner version of India. Certainly in 1961, before Lyndon Johnson raised the quota system by the Alien Registration Act, that was 65, remember? There was not much of a Bengali community or anything at Godown. And anyway, I don't think I would have chosen, sought out Bengalis. I was too much like Borges's Arab. I didn't need camels. You know what I mean? I was fine. So therefore, yeah, that it was just, I did not feel that I was culturally somewhere else. You know,
how did you end up at Cornell?
Oh boy, that's a story, very well-known story to all my friends. Because I was told that I would not get a first class in my MA because I'd been very critical of the university. And at that time, especially since my father was dead, and, you know, I certainly couldn't, I did not think I was going to get a scholarship anywhere. And I never have had a very strong self-concept or sense of being, like I said, an intellectual. I can't think of myself as an intellectual. So I thought I should leave. And so I was young, I was 18, and I was such a fool that I didn't realize that I knew people at the American, at USIS, for example. I knew I would go to the United States, that I was not going to go to Britain. And because I thought that Britain, you know, everybody, they were all Anglomaniacs at home, right? Mm. I thought there was no way I was going to get in. And so I was going to go to the United States. I knew people, after all, at USIS because I was a debater. Mm. But it never occurred to me that that's where I should go to get advice. Mm. So I thought to myself, I hadn't told anyone that I was going to go. So I thought to myself, Harvard and Yale are too good for me. You see, so what was I thinking? You were asking myself, did I have a sense of being a woman? That certainly I did feel, because everybody said at presidency, not my parents, not my home upbringing, but everybody said, you know, Gayatri does well in her exams because she's such a good-looking young thing, and she's flashy, but the real brains are like Shurajit Sen and so on and so forth. But at any rate, so I thought I wouldn't get in. And so Harvard and Yale too good. So I chose Cornell for that reason. And then I sent them, I remember from Baliganj post office, a telegram saying I was a very good student, which indeed I was. I'd come first class firstly by BA in English honors, but I didn't need financial assistance because I thought I wouldn't get a scholarship. And so then, unbeknownst to everyone, I borrowed money on a life mortgage. I don't believe there was such a thing as life mortgage in those days. I think the guy who actually made me sign that thing, whom I didn't know, D.N. Banerjee, who was the managing director of Metropolitan Insurance Company or something. I remember his office. I'd heard his name in some conversation as a philanthropist. And so I went to his office day after day after day without an appointment. So he called me in, and then he finally agreed to lend me the money on a life mortgage. And it's so silly. He then said that he would give me the money for a one-way ticket, and then he would give me money for every month, but only if I could show a letter signed by a teacher. Imagine, I really fell on it. Good person. And later this guy went to jail for embezzlement. But anyway, so I would only get, and so Demand would sign a letter every month, and so I would get $582 for both my dorm and my, my fees or whatever it was. I don't remember exactly what that $582 represented. And then second year, you know, you were talking about complete. There was no complete at that point. So I actually learned French at the Alliance Française in Calcutta in 1960, one semester. And my German was from, for 3 months with Mrs. Bahaduri, Imgard Bahaduri, who was the widow of a Bengali freedom fighter. You may be able to research his name. I didn't know who that was. She was a widow. And so, since I was not a native speaker, I couldn't get a fellowship in English second year. And so Diman offered me a fellowship in Complete, but said, you know, you can't take a language course. And so my French and German are not very good, you know. I mean, I'm good with the languages, so, I mean, I can lecture in French, but I never took a grammar course after that. So, you know, people mock me a little, but that's fine. I can live with that one. But so that's how it was coming. That's why I came to Cornell. And that's how the beginning of my time in the United States was.
Thank you. Well, maybe we'll end there.
And, why not?
Thank you very much for this interview.